Hello and welcome to Haaretz Weekly, your audio guide to Israel, the Middle East and the Jewish world. I'm Simon Spungin. On today's show... It's been a little under 2 weeks since Israelis voted for the fourth time in 2 years in a general election, the results of which appear to have raised more questions than they've answered. Here with me, hopefully to answer some of those questions, I'm joined by Haaretz columnist and Netanyahu biographer, the indefatigable Anshul Pfeffer. How's it going, mate?
Hi, Simon. Not bad. How are you?
All things considered, as we like to say. Anshul, I don't usually reference the song that we play in the intro. I couldn't resist it this time. I couldn't think of anything more suitable than Stuck in the Middle with You. You know, clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Perfect, isn't it?
Well, yeah, racist to the left of me, homophobes to the right. Here I am, stuck on the very far extreme of the political spectrum.
We will get back to that. We do have a big week of news coming up. Consultations with President Rivlin over who's going to form the next government. The evidentiary stage of Netanyahu's fraud, bribery and breach of trust trial. And nuclear talks with Iran. And on top of all that, Israel has to decide how to respond to the International Criminal Court's investigation into alleged war crimes. Where on earth should we start? Maybe the big question should be, when are you relaunching the Election Overdose podcast, Anshul?
Well, I mean, you've just made the most convincing argument why Israel needs to have a functioning government right now. You know, it's not just the fact that the last state budget was passed at the end of 2018, and, you know, thanks to the vaccinations, thank you very much, Netanyahu. You know, Israel is about to have this opportunity to relaunch its economy, and there's no way a budget will be passed in the next few months with the politics the way it is. And all those things you've mentioned, the ICC, the talks with the US-Iran talks, well, proximity talks in Vienna, and there's a coup in Jordan, and just the list keeps getting longer of important major challenges on this government's agenda. And there is no government. There's Netanyahu and Benny Gantz is defense minister, but they're not on speaking terms. And there's no justice minister. Another whole list of ministers not appointed because the government can't function. And that may be the one reason why my co-host Dalia Shendin and I will not be relaunching our Election Overdose podcast in a few months, because I think that this time it may be different. This time there are too many people in the political arena who are really fed up and don't want another rematch.
Mm. You mentioned a coup in Jordan. I mean, maybe we should be renaming your podcast Overthrow Overdose, given Netanyahu's claim that there's a coup underway against him. Is that really all that he has to offer at this stage of his public media defense?
Yeah, but Netanyahu's been claiming a coup against him since late 2014 when he fired then Finance Minister Yair Lapid and Justice Minister Tzipi Livni. So the coup is a bit of a, you know, it's been
the least effective coup in human history.
7 years in the making. Maybe finally the coup here will yield something. And it, I mean, if you look at, you know, if you sort of read between the lines of the rather meager statements by the party leaders and sort of speak to people around them, there is a determination. Yeah, we could have said that in the last round as well, but there does seem to be more of a determination this time to prevent a fifth election. I don't think I can say how that's going to happen, because it seems, you know, even less likely that this time that someone will find the formula for coalition. But, you know, where there's a will, there's a way. And, you know, let's also look at Rivlin, who is President Rivlin, who will be tomorrow, or whenever this is coming out, Monday morning, we'll start greeting the party representatives who are coming for consultations. He has 4 months left in office. He doesn't want to leave with another election on the way. He wants to finally help to form a government this time. And I put my money on a government being formed this time.
You wrote about Ruvi Rivlin and his dilemma. You pointed out that he's the only Israeli president to have endured five election campaigns during his tenure. He must be heartily sick of it all.
I mean, I've spoken to some people close to him. The level of frustrations in the president's office are really sky high. And he's sick of it. And just think of it, the president gets 7 years, and towards the end of it, the president wants to have a bit of a legacy tour kind of period where he can deal with his pet projects and try and put down some kind of a marker. And Rivlin tried to establish this dialogue between what he called the tribes of Israel, and he's ending his term with the tribes of Israel more split and polarized than ever. And if there's no government by that point, then it will really be a very dismal end to his term. And he's determined to do everything he can to try and prevent that.
And Bibi's long accused Rivlin of plotting against him. If he were, this would be the perfect time. Now, is there anything that he could do behind the scenes? Is he talking to party leaders before they come to him for consultations?
I am not aware of that. If he would be doing so, it would be highly improper. However, this is Israel. This is, I'm talking to you from Jerusalem. It's a small town. Rivlin knows everybody. He's met them so many times. Gideon Saar was the head of the committee to get Rivlin elected president back in 2014. He's worked with Saar for so many years. He's close to him. Saar is probably one of the main pivots here who will be trying to bring Naftali Bennett and other right-wing elements, perhaps also ultra-Orthodox elements, into a new non-Netanyahu government. So even if Rivlin and Saar are not speaking, and I don't think they're speaking because they do have a sense, both of them have a sense of Jabotinsky and decorum and dignity, and they're playing by the rules, they know what each other's thinking. They're synchronized. But Rivlin has to abide by tradition. He can't not give the mandate to whoever gets the most endorsement. If he does so, there will be a break with tradition. Though it's allowed by law, the law gives him very, very wide discretion in choosing who upon whom to confer the mandate. But he knows that if he does something against tradition, even if it's legal, this will help Netanyahu to delegitimize any replacement of him.
And in any case, the timetable would see us approaching the time when Rivlin, by law, has to step down.
That's, if I'm not mistaken, I think on the 7th of July. Now, the timing of how long the coalition building process will take, is that's something that Rivlin can control, because Rivlin can decide whether or not to, let's say the first person who gets the mandate, and the mandate has to be conferred by Wednesday evening, a week after Rivlin was handed the official results. But once the mandate is given, it's a 28-day with a 14-day extension. Once those 6 weeks are over, assuming the guy who gets it exhausts the time and fails to form a coalition, Rivlin can choose to give it to another candidate for another 28 days, but he can also choose to toss it immediately to the Knesset for the last 21 days and shorten dramatically the period, and perhaps help focus the minds of the party leaders. I think that the fact that Rivlin chose to invite the party leaders tomorrow morning, Monday morning, 9:30 a.m., just 30 minutes after the proceedings in Netanyahu's case will have resumed, and will all be focused on the opening statement of Prosecutor Liat Ben-Ari, I don't think that is coincidental. I think that Rivlin is using that also to focus the minds of the party leaders. Tomorrow will be one of those split-screen days where we'll have on all the Israeli television channels, on one side the Jerusalem District Court, on the other side the president's residence. And it will be impossible to escape that that connection between the events. And I think Riven is hoping that it'll also push some of the party leaders to make difficult decisions.
Mm. Who are the party leaders who are most likely or liable, depending on your point of view, to make those difficult, surprising decisions?
Well, it's no secret Naftali Bennett is, he's not exactly the kingmaker anymore, because Ram, the Islamist party led by Mansour Abbas, is also sort of a joint kingmaker. Mansour Abbas said basically that he can join either side, left or right. We're still waiting for Bennett to say specifically that he is capable of finally breaking with Netanyahu and supporting a coalition which will be, if it ever comes into being, will include also center and center left parties. And that's something that's the Rubicon he's yet to cross. And you know, it's in a way almost an act of patricide or regicide against the man that he has admired and yearned to be accepted by for so long, Benjamin Netanyahu.
And you mentioned Mansour Abbas, who has, you know, I think we've run out of our quota of cliches calling him the new kingmaker. He got the rare honor of a live primetime TV address last week.
And a lot of people have been saying, well, what Mansour Abbas said on Thursday about him wanting to be part of the government, wanting to be, you know, to reconciliate and have this new closeness between the different communities of Israel, that wasn't new. And Ayman Udeh, the leader of Jordan, says similar things in the past. Why didn't Ayman Udeh get that kind of attention? And the answer is very clear. It's not necessarily about what you say in the speech. It's about the context. And the context is that Mansour Abbas is now positioning himself as someone who can join either the right or the left government. Ayman Udeh never said that he could join a right-wing government. He can't. He's a communist. He has a clear ideology. He can't put his ideology so much to one side that he could join a right-wing government. Whereas it's interesting that communist dogma is less flexible than Islamism in this case. And it turns out that Mansour Abbas, despite being the political leader of part of Israel's Islamic movement, is capable of saying, you know, I'm going to put my Palestinian and my Arab and Muslim desires and ideology to one side and join a government so I can get funding for my community. And you know, that's something that Udeh could never do. And that is why Mansour Abbas's speeches was on primetime 8 p.m. television on Thursday evening.
Could Abbas sit in the same government as the neo-Kahanists that Netanyahu helped usher into this Knesset?
Well, he hasn't spoken specifically about any party he could or couldn't sit with.
Talking about who's saying yes rather than saying no.
Yeah, he said, I'm about saying yes rather than about saying no. Some people close to him, some of Ram's representatives, said no, that joining a coalition with Ben-Gvir and Smotrich with the neo-Kahanists would be crossing a red line. And they've been saying the same thing about Ram as well. So that is the biggest minefield for Netanyahu right now, that he could conceivably form a coalition with Ram, with Bennett, with the far right, and with the Haredim. He would have 63 seats. The problem is that two of those parties, the list called Religious Zionism, and Ram refused to sit with each other. And that's why Netanyahu is stuck right now.
Which one of them is more pragmatic, the Ram or the Kahanists?
I think Ram is more pragmatic. Ram saying that they would sit with the right or with the left. You know, the Kahanists is, you know, will just be a member of a right-wing government. So, yeah, right now, Mansour Abbas, the dentist and lay preacher from Ra'ar, in Galilee, is looking very pragmatic.
Could Netanyahu be counting on defectors to get his coalition? I imagine he has a list of potential turncoats.
He would obviously love to get some defectors, but not so much the defectors will make up the numbers, because even if he gets a couple of defectors and gets to 61, somehow it'd still be a nightmarish coalition. But he wants the defectors to do what the defector, the one defector of the previous election, Oli Levi Abikassis, who defected from the Labour, Geshe, and Merits list after the election. What that does, you know, once you have defectors, it, you know, it makes the resolve of opposition parties not to join Netanyahu's coalition, you know, it weakens that resolve. It's what it did that to Benny Gantz. Benny Gantz finally capitulated. So, you know, if a defector from Blue and White or from New Hope or from Yamina were to turn over and join the Netanyahu bloc, it would make it that much more difficult for these parties to continue saying, well, we're not going to sit with Netanyahu, when some of their members have already agreed to do so. So that's really what Netanyahu is looking for. He's trying to bring Saar and Bennett in, you know, back to the fold of his government. And defectors is one way of making that happen.
And it would also help him to blur the lines between the pro-Netanyahu camp and the anti-Netanyahu camp and muddy those waters even further, which he's been doing, you know, in his tweets ever since the election. I was impressed, by the way, Anshul, how you managed to find a silver lining in the fact that almost a quarter of a million Israelis voted for, as you put it, racism, homophobia and misogyny. Explain how that's a silver lining. There's a silver lining in there.
Look, it's an abomination. I can't find a better word that many Israelis voted for, you know, the worst of Jewish ideologies and any kind of ideology almost out there for, you know, for homophobia, misogyny and racism. However, amongst those voters are probably between 30 to 60,000 Haredim. And that is a significant thing because they were told by their rabbis to vote either for United Torah Judaism or for Shas. And they disobeyed their rabbis and went and voted for a party which is a non-Haredi party. It has some Haredi elements, and it's certainly been appealing to Haredi voters, but it's a list which was officially not accepted by the rabbis, and they still went and voted for it. And this is, you know, this is something that hasn't happened for decades. You know, we've seen, especially UTJ, go up and up and up and up because of the demographics and because their base is stable, because everybody votes in the way their rabbis say. And suddenly, for the very first time since UTJ was formed back in 92, this is the 12th election since, this is the first time that their vote has gone down, and it's gone significantly. They've got about 10% down. And not only was it supposed to go up because of demographics, it was supposed to stay solid because of the rabbis. So you have 10% of ultra-Orthodox Israelis define the rabbis, and this is something we've never seen happening in an election before. And it means something very clear. It means that the authority of the rabbis is eroding. And we know this is happening. We see it in other statistics, the fact that the age of marriage has slowly, slowly been going up, and the number of children in the Haredi family is very slowly starting to go down. We see that in the number of Haredi men and women who go to academic studies or vocational studies. We see it in all the Haredim. We can see on social media against their rabbis' orders. Now we're seeing it in the election, and this is a major thing because, you know, that's the biggest mitzvah of the Haredi community is to go and show the world that you vote according to what your rabbis tell you to do. One in ten didn't.
It's a bit of a bittersweet silver lining, though, when we're opting for Israeli fascism over Israeli theocracy.
Well, you know, obviously we'd prefer them to go and vote for nice lefty parties like Labour and Meretz. But the fact that the control of the rabbis is eroding is a huge development. It means that the basis of ultra-Orthodox life and the Orthodox community, which has been for the last 70, 80 years, since it's basically since the Holocaust, and this is not happening not just in Israel, happening also in the United States. We saw that in 2016 with the way that rabbis in some Hasidic communities wanted their followers to vote for the Democrats, or and in that case for Hillary Clinton, because of all kind of local deals that they have in the state and the local council levels and so on. But part of that, they wanted them to vote Democrat the whole ticket, and 90%+ in these Haredi townships in New York State voted for Trump. And this is now also being seen here in Israel. The rabbis do not have that kind of power anymore over their followers. And this means that this, you know, we've been talking for so many years about the demographics of the Haredi community means that one day they may be a majority of Israel or a majority among the Jewish people, that probably won't happen because there are massive changes happening within the Haredi young generation. They don't want that kind of life where they do whatever the rabbis say and have 12 children every family and live in poverty just so they can continue whatever tradition the rabbis have semi-invented for them. It's going to change. Now, right now, it's changing, not in a great way, because a lot of them went to vote for the fascists. But that in itself was a major break, and I think we'll see very interesting developments in that community over the next few years.
It also shows that they're not immune to the charms of the populist politicians, you know, the Trumps and the Netanyahus.
Certainly, but what's interesting here is this is the first time that a non-Haredi party has made a serious attempt at appealing to Haredi voters. Until now, all the parties accepted the Haredi voters sort of off limits. You know, they will vote according to what their rabbis say. Nobody wasted time on them. But Bezalel Smotrich and Itamar Ben-Gvir actually made a major effort to appeal to these voters. And what's going to happen if other parties, less fascist parties, make an attempt? You know, there is a growing proportion of the Haredi community who are looking outside for what to vote and how to lead their lives and what to study and to leave yeshivas and work. I'm not saying that they're going to immediately stop being Haredi, but the meaning today of being a Haredi Jew is to follow your rabbi's orders. You know, that's beginning to change.
Maybe in the next election campaign, we'll see Mansour Abbas stumping in Yiddish.
I can't wait.
So listen, while we're stuck in this seemingly endless spiral of elections, the rest of the world marches on, Anshul. This week sees the resumption of talks aimed at kickstarting the Iranian nuclear deal. It almost feels like we're asking too much of Bibi to have time for that, on top of everything else that he's got going on. How do we think he's going to handle these talks, which, you know, the Biden administration will be part of?
Well, the truth is he isn't handling it because he's focused right now on his political survival. He's focused on his trial. He doesn't have the same kind of access to the administration anymore because this is the Biden administration, not the Trump administration. He doesn't have Ron Dermer in Washington anymore. Mm. The whole apparatus which was built around Netanyahu and his own personal connections, his own personal emissaries and plenipotentiaries is already crumbling with Netanyahu still in office. And Netanyahu is an extremely capable leader and politician. I'm sure he is devoting some of his time to this, but he doesn't have the team anymore. And the foreign minister, Gabi Ashkenazi, he doesn't trust him. He doesn't trust Benny Gantz, the defense minister. The whole Netanyahu way of doing business is now beginning to is teetering on the brink of bankruptcy, and this is even before he's been removed from office. And it's not just the talks in Vienna; it's all the other things that are happening in the region. That he's a human being. He doesn't have the attention span to deal with all these things that are happening. And sadly, we are focused as the media mainly on these local spectacles of the election and the coalition building and of the trial. And we're not really, you and I talking about this right now in the podcast, but this is sort of, it isn't getting enough attention in the media right now. And if it was, perhaps that would also help to focus the minds of the party leaders and help them push them towards the difficult decisions that need to be made.
And the same could be said of the International Criminal Court war crimes probe, right? I mean, Judy Maltz reported over the weekend that just a few days before the deadline for responding, Bibi finally got round to convening a meeting to discuss Israel's response.
Yes, it's scheduled for Tuesday. Who knows? Maybe they won't meet. I mean, so many of the important meetings that Netanyahu has scheduled over the last year have been postponed or cancelled, and perhaps that is his that may be his intention. Maybe he wants he doesn't want to answer the ICC, and that is also a potential strategy to ignore the ICC. But at least that kind of strategy should be should be discussed and other options weighed as well. So don't forget there is no justice minister now because Netanyahu has refused to appoint a justice minister. Justice Minister would be an important part of any team preparing a response to the ICC. Well, yet again, another example how Netanyahu's focus on his own personal and political survival trumps all other considerations.
And one court that he won't be able to ignore is the Jerusalem court tomorrow morning, where he has to hear the charges read out against him.
He actually has already heard that. He's going to hear the opening remarks of the prosecutor, Liat Ben-Ari, which are expected to be quite lengthy. And this is, I spoke to a couple of people who were involved in the Olmert case. So this is a very dramatic moment, because Netanyahu has known for the last 2-3 years that they've been assembling a case against him. You know, he knows who Liat Ben-Ari is. Liat Ben-Ari is now this demon figure in pro-Netanyahu social media, and every real and imagined detail of her life has already been raked over and used against her, and in countless social media posts slashing at her. But finally, she'll be coming face to face with him, and she'll be looking at him, she'll be a few meters away from him, and she'll be saying everything that she's been working on for the last 2 or 3 years. That's a massive moment. And Netanyahu will sit there, probably he'll keep his face mask on and try to remain poker faced. But just think that somebody has been collecting information about you and preparing a case against you for the last 2 or 3 years, and suddenly you come face to face with that person. It's not a massive courtroom. It's they've actually taken two courtrooms and turned them into one. But still, it's a close quarters. It's going to be a very dramatic moment.
And listener, you can obviously follow events in that Jerusalem courtroom on haaretz.com throughout the day. Anshul, I think that about wraps it up for us. Thank you for your time, as always.
Big day tomorrow. Big day.
Absolutely. It's going to be fascinating. My thanks to our producer, Aaron Ehrlich, and to you, listener. We'll be back again next week with another episode of Haaretz Weekly. Until then, shalom from Tel Aviv.